So sometimes I like to imagine what the Buddha was like as a young man, as Siddhartha, before he became this legend. It's one of the things that kind of drew me to Buddhism in the beginning. I was raised as a Catholic, and in Catholicism, you know, as a young child, your understanding is it's a very exoteric religion. God is out there. Jesus is out there. The Holy Ghost, which I never understood, is out there. And that you invite them into your heart and you pray to them, but it's always a me versus you kind of relationship. And God is just so far out there that you may worship him, you may ask for help, but it's a very sort of obsequious relationship. And what I loved from the very beginning about when I first read about the Buddha and Buddhism was that Buddha was just a guy, like any of the rest of us. That there is this idea of Buddha mind and the seven Buddhas before Buddha and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, there was still this historic figure, Siddhartha Gautama. And he was a little boy, and he probably did all the bad things that little boys all do everywhere. And his mother loved him. And yes, there was this incredible prophecy when he was born. But I think that part of that is the time. In India, you know, it was filled with sages and mysticism, and, you know, they were very close to the earth. And in recent years, people like Stephen Batchelor have gone back and looked at all the early literature. And, you know, we have this idea, there's this mythology that Siddhartha was a prince, and he lived in this castle in a kingdom, the kingdom of Shakya. Well, further research has shown that, first of all, it isn't a castle. It's more like the headman's domain. And the king wasn't the king in the way that we think of, like, King Arthur. You know? He was the headman of the village. It was a small place. And there weren't so many people back then. So it was like if you were a king, you were, how many people were you the king of, you know? But what we do understand is that Siddhartha was raised in privilege. He was the son of the most important man in that area at that time. And he was probably very pampered. And because of that prophecy, he was also very sheltered. Because, let's face it, if you were told today that your son or daughter was either going to go off and be a mystic sage and, you know, wear a little dhoti and grow a long beard or long hair and but bring enlightenment to a lot of people, versus your son or daughter are going to be, you know, the next ruler of the world, you can understand that his father wanted the latter, not the former. And so they sheltered him, and they kept a lot of things from him, and they surrounded him with everything he could want, which is a little different than everything we could want today. In fact, it's a lot different. You know, you're not going to get a car at your 16th birthday. You're not going to have an Xbox to listen to all your music and videos on. What you wanted in those days was a lot less. But he did have a chariot, and he had a charioteer at his command. Chana is told one day by the teenage, late 20s Buddha, Siddhartha, I want to go out into the village now. I'm getting a little bored here in the palace, in my little enclave. And Chana has to do what Siddhartha says. So even though he's been warned by the parents, we don't want him to go out and see what's out there, they go. So imagine, you know, think back. Some of you are, but most of us aren't. Think back to your late 20s and who you were. I was beginning to be a little more serious about my life. My early 20s, not at all. I was into having a good time and enjoying myself, maybe getting a little education on the side, but I was out for new experiences. And it was only in my late 20s that I began to think a little more seriously, and I assume that's what Siddhartha was doing. So he was getting bored with his sheltered life, even though he had this brand new, beautiful wife and a little boy, little baby boy. So Chana takes him out. And the first thing he sees is, whoa, 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 Chana, stop. What's that? And Chana says, well, Lord, that's illness. Now, first of all, how many of you got to the age of 27, 28 without ever having been ill? How the Buddha did not know what that meant is truly amazing. But of course, this is a story, to some degree, a parable of closing our eyes to what's in front of us. So he's a little horrified. And Chana says, you know, this pretty much happens to everybody because of the way we live. You know, out in this world, you know, our food doesn't get washed, perhaps, and it's not very clean, and disease gets spread through germs, and so people get sick. The next day, he wants to go out again, because now he's intrigued. And they're going along in the chariot again, and finally, whoa, 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 wait a minute. What's the matter with that man? Oh, there's nothing the matter with him, Lord. He's just very old. Well, so probably the only old person in his life is his father and mother. Probably everybody else has been sort of banished from the enclave. And he's never seen a truly old person. But of course, in those days, truly old meant 50. Okay. And it wasn't the years, it was the mileage. Okay. People looked really old long before their time compared to today. So it's like, whoa, old age. Okay. And it goes out a third day. And a funeral procession is going by. And he has never seen a dead body. Now, you might think to yourself, wow, by the age of 27, 28, how could you have not seen a dead body? Certainly your grandparents must have died by that time. But in fact, probably some of you have never actually seen, been next to, touched a dead body. Because in our time, this is all hidden away. It happens in the hospitals, it happens in the mortuaries. Sometimes it happens in our personal lives. But I know lots of people who have never seen for themselves a dead body until it is the dead body of a beloved. And that's not a great time to see your first dead body. But this is probably what happened to Siddhartha. Death was kept from him, because his parents didn't want him to have to think about those things too much, because they knew that thinking about those things would lead to thinking about other things like impermanence. But by the time he sees the dead body, his mind is churning. And he comes up with the same question that eventually we all come to at some point. Some people don't come to it until they're on their deathbed, but everybody comes to it at some point. Why do we have to suffer? What is that? Who am I? Why am I in this world? You know, it's all sort of the same question. And so the story goes that on the fourth day he went out, he sees an ascetic sage. And what's that? Well, that is a monk, sire. Well, what do they do? They question the meaning of life. Well, that's already what's happening for him. And in that moment, he realizes he will never be satisfied with the life he has had. It's one of those before and after moments, and we all have them in our life. Before, I was happy-go-lucky. I didn't have to think about any of this stuff. I have this beautiful wife, a beautiful child, a great life. And now, all of a sudden, I have seen this whole other thing. And you can imagine, he's 29 years old. And he has to go back to his mother and father and his beautiful wife and tell them he's leaving. He knows they are not going to understand. So the story is that he actually doesn't go and tell them. He tries actually to sneak out completely, but of course he needs Chana's help. He does go and visit his wife one last time. Supposedly she's asleep, but there's other stories that say she woke up. And she is not happy about it, but she realizes she has to let him go to do whatever it is he's got to do. It takes him 6 years, which is not a long time at all when you think about how long we all have been practicing. He goes off with his five special friends that he gathers along the way, and they go to every famous teacher of the day. And in India at that time, there were a lot of them. And everyone had their own sort of method for penetrating to the truth. And Siddhartha, of course, he apparently was brilliant and had a deep understanding already. And so every time he'd show up, he'd be with that teacher for a short period of time and would grasp their teachings completely, to the point that many of them begged him to stay and share the teaching seat with them, because they knew this was an amazing person who really deeply understood the true nature of reality. But none of them could answer his question. They had all of these incredible philosophical theories and plans of action, but no one was really able to answer why is there suffering. So Buddha, Siddhartha, and his friends make the classic mistake, which is, the body is what is keeping me from understanding. And this was a common idea at the time. The body had to be castigated. It had to be rubbed down to a nub, because it was the body that was always asking for things. The body wants sleep. The body wants food. The body wants water. The body wants luxury. It wants comfort. It wants a massage every now and then. And the only way to stop all of these desires of the body is to ignore the body. And that is what they set out to do. So that finally, when the famous scene arrives before Buddha's enlightenment, he is wasted away. You see his rib cage and his skin and bones, because they have been fasting and denying their body for so long that he is now on the verge of dying. And part of that story is about the nature of crisis. And sometimes it takes a crisis for us to wake up. So there he is. He's almost dying when little Sujata comes along with her goat milk. And she looks and she says, whoa, this guy's in really bad shape. And she's supposed to take it back to her village, but she stops and she offers him some. Oh, this is a huge crisis. The Buddha's promised his friends he will deny his body until he understands. But he also knows that he is on the edge of dying. And fortunately for us, his wisdom came forth and he said yes. So he drinks this goat milk and begins to revive. And this is actually the first understanding that he has. You cannot deny the body, not to that extent. Consciousness always exists. Mind is everywhere. It has always been everywhere. It is nowhere that you are not or that you are. You are part of it. Everything is part of it. For you to be conscious of mind, however, requires a body. It is the body that houses that consciousness. We don't know how it works. We have lots of theories. There's lots of science that's been done around it. But really and truly, if you have ever been around someone who has died right in front of you, you know it is hard to explain. 1 minute the consciousness is there, and the next minute it's not. It's just a body. So this is his first great understanding. I need this body, because the body houses consciousness. And then he goes and he sits under the bow tree with this great bow and will not move from this spot until I wake up. And 3 days later, voila. It's just like all those koan stories. And then the monk was enlightened. So the Buddha at that point now has to make this decision. It's like anything, you know, I feel like this a lot of times when you're talking about the Dharma, when you're talking about practice, you know that you can't actually touch it. You can't actually put your finger on it any more than I can put my finger on this thing I call myself. Everybody has to experience it for themselves. And, you know, at this point, it's just words. It's just the finger pointing at the moon. It is not the moon. And I am sure that after such a great opening, that the Buddha thought, how on earth could I possibly explain this to anyone? But his bodhisattva nature prevails. And he says, okay, my five friends have been so faithful and loyal, and they're going to berate me for having the goat's milk, but that's okay. It's worthwhile to go and talk to them. And lo and behold, yes, they sort of, you know, frown at him at first, but the more he talks to them, the more they realize he really did have a deep awakening. And within days, he has managed to wake them all up, or they have awakened themselves through him. And that is the beginning of the practice that gets passed down and comes through all of our teachers to us. But the Buddha had two main teachings right at the beginning. The first were the Four Noble Truths. And the second were the 12 links of causation, dependent origination. So those two things, though, were based on his previous understanding, which was fairly common at the time, of the three marks of existence. Those three marks are the truth of suffering, which he incorporated into the Four Noble Truths, the truth of impermanence, and the truth of emptiness, no self. So he posits the truth of suffering, the causes of suffering. He goes deep and realizes, you know, thirsting, desire, aversion, and delusion. Delusion of what? The nature of reality, emptiness. And then he says, but the good news is it can end. He doesn't say it's going to end all the time forever, but it can end in the next moment. It can end in this moment. It can end. And then he gives us this path to follow, these guidelines. And the very first one is right view. Right view of what? Emptiness. So we have to understand that emptiness is so important. It was the first of the Eightfold Path. It is the first thing that we really deeply have to understand. Impermanence, you know, they're called the three marks of existence because you could explain it to anyone in non-Buddhist language and they would agree with you. There's nobody who would disagree with the truth of suffering. You know, everybody has suffering in their life. And no one's going to disagree with the truth of impermanence. You know, everything changes, whether we want it to or not. The third one, emptiness, that one you have to talk about in a different way. You can't use the word emptiness. It's a terrible word anyway. It has this idea of, you know, this is full and something's empty and therefore it's nihilistic, and people get all confused about that. I always like what Thich Nhat Hanh said, though. If the glass is empty instead of filled with water right now, What is it empty of? It's empty of a separate, independent self. Because there really is no such thing as that kind of separation. It looks like there are all these separate bodies in the room. But we know that in the absolute sense, which would include the atomic view, we're just a whole bunch of atoms. And this group right here is all closely clustered together, and then there's looser atoms in between, and then there's a whole bunch of tightly clustered atoms again, and so on around the room. But recently I came across a quote from a Western philosopher that I hadn't seen before, in which he describes this very thing. And I thought, oh, good, because for people who aren't Buddhists, to talk about emptiness as one of the three self-evident truths of the universe is not always easy. But here, the Scottish philosopher David Hume figured it out himself. He proposed a thought experiment. So this is something you can do with other people that you're explaining this to. He said, simply try turning your attention inwards and try to find this thing you call yourself. Hume had made the attempt many times, he claimed, but he could never succeed. Instead of a self, all he ever found were specific processes, emotions, sensations, and thoughts. It's just like in the Heart Sutra, right? Where was the self that was feeling those emotions, sensing those sensations, and thinking those thoughts? Hume was stumped. Here is what he wrote about it. For my part, when I enter most intimately into what I call myself, I always stumble on some particular perception or other of heat or cold, light or shade, love or hatred, pain or pleasure. I can never catch myself at any time without a perception, and never can observe anything but the perception. When my perceptions are removed for any time, as by sound sleep, so long as I am insensible of myself and may truly be said not to exist. If anyone upon serious and unprejudiced reflection thinks he has a different notion of himself, I must confess I can reason no longer with him. So even in Western philosophy, there are people who have looked at this notion of self and seen how nebulous it is, how impossible it is to put our finger on something permanent and never changing. When you get up in the morning and you look in the mirror, you may say, oh yes, there I am again. No, not really. Recently I had the experience of watching, I think, 25 or maybe even 30 years of photographs of a small group that I belong to. Now, I do know that I'm older than I was 30 years ago, and I do know I have changed a little, but generally when I look in the mirror, it's me that I see. And here are all these photos, and the first thing that came into my mind was, wow, we are all a lot older now. And I thought, well, that's pretty stupid. Of course we are. But if you just keep looking at yourself day to day, you don't see the change. But for instance, I'm going back to school next week, and there are small children I haven't seen in 3 months. They're going to look completely different, because 3 months in a child's life is huge. 3 months in mine, I don't change very much on the outside. But children change a lot, and right there you see it. There is no separate, unchanging self ever. It just gets harder to see as we get older. So that was the Four Noble Truths, and then the other main teaching of the Buddha was the 12 links of causation, or dependent origination. This is because that is. And it's a wheel because even though we usually start at ignorance, which is ignorance of emptiness, you can enter anywhere on the wheel. And so the 12 links, usually, as I say, we start with ignorance, which goes to volitional actions, to consciousness, name and form, the six sense organs, contact, feeling and sensation, desire, clinging and grasping, then new existence coming into being, birth, old age, and death, and back to ignorance. Now, the beauty of this wheel, if you study it carefully and you watch yourself and every thought you have going around that wheel, there are places on the wheel where it is easier to stop. So, for instance, one of the places where it is easier to stop is when you have a feeling sensation and then you have thirsting desire. You know, someone's touching your body and giving you a massage. Oh, that feels really good. And then the desire is, oh, please continue. Clinging and grasping, somewhere between it doesn't that feel good to, wow, please continue, to, I don't ever want this to stop. That's a great place that you can stop the wheel. You can get off. Because it is our not wanting those things to stop or wanting them to stop, that's where suffering happens, you know, the clinging, the grasping. So when you're thinking in Zazen, you know, at some point you're going to notice that you're thinking. It's just what we do. Are you going to be able to let the thought go and come back to your breath? Or is it one of those really juicy thoughts and you just really kind of want to stay there and you want to start clinging and grasping, and then the next thing you know you're having an argument with someone that you had 20 years ago because you never really solved it then and you just really want to hold on to it now. And you can be as angry today as you were 20 years ago, and there's your suffering. So the Buddha said, at some point though, you can cut it off. You can cut off the thought. And you can return to the present moment where that isn't happening and go back to your breath. There's a couple of other places where it's easier to get off the wheel. The great thing about the 12 links of causation is that they offer a meaningful explanation of the problem of suffering. As long as ignorance of your connection, of your interbeing, remains, and craving, this clinging and grasping part, remain, then the round of rebirth around that circle continues. Karma yields pleasant and painful fruit, and there's a great mass of suffering that accumulates from all of this. When you get off the wheel, and when you transcend karma, in that moment, no suffering. Maybe in the next moment, but not in that moment. So, about 5 years ago, I had this experience. I had been doing a 2-week retreat with Gail Fronsdahl. And it happened right at the beginning of school, which is like the worst time for me to do a retreat. But I'd been wanting to do it for a long time, so I took 2 weeks off at the beginning of school. And I had my assistant do my work in the library. And it's a teaching position at my school. And every class from nursery through fifth grade comes to the library for a certain time during the week, and there's reading out loud and books to be chosen and some library skills, things like that. So my assistant is taking my place for those 2 weeks. And when I come back, somebody saw me outside walking towards the building, and they said, my God, it looks like you're floating, because it had just been such an amazing retreat. And I was so happy to be back at school. And then I find out from my assistant that the fourth graders in particular were not very nice to her. I thought, really? In my school, that's kind of unusual, especially, we don't usually have this problem with substitutes because she's the Friday librarian anyway, so they know her. So I asked her about it, and she said, oh, they wouldn't stop talking while I was reading. I had to keep stopping, and I finally sent one of them back to class, which is really unusual. I thought, okay. So when they came in, I sat down and I said, so, here's what I hear. And I have to say I'm kind of surprised and a little disappointed, I suppose, because this is somebody who's here to read a book to you. I mean, how nice is that? And I don't know what was going on for all of you those 2 days that she was with you, but I want to talk about the nature of consequences, which is another word for karma. I said, so who can tell me what consequences are? And one boy raised his hand, and he nailed it right away. He said, oh, that's just whatever happens from the thing that you did before. I said, that's right, good or bad, right? I mean, or neutral. Yeah. See, I think there's a misunderstanding generally that karma is always bad karma. Right? But karma is just the consequence of whatever happened in this moment. So it's going to give rise to the next moment. And then that's going to give rise to the next moment. So if you're doing something generous and kind in this moment, then in the next moment, probably it will continue and up until such time as something changes. So I told them, I said, okay, so here there's going to be some consequences. If you start talking while I'm reading this book out loud, I'm not going to stop you. And I'm not going to ask you to stop talking. And I'm definitely not sending you back to class. I'm just going to sit here. I'm going to close the book. And I'll just sit here while you talk. But you won't be hearing the story. When you're all quiet again, I'll start reading again. Now, I had been teaching 18 or 19 years by the time I tried this. It was astonishing. A few times, as the year progressed, some kid would start talking to another kid, and I would just very calmly stop reading. I didn't have to say anything. They said it to each other. You shut up so we can have the story. It was great. I've used it ever since. Kids understand consequences. We all actually understand consequences, but a lot of the time we're not paying attention to consequences. And so it turns out that one of the big lessons from those 12 links has to do with karma. You start on the wheel, and it's karma that takes you forward. So for instance, if your karma in the past has been to respond in a thirsting desire way, if you're a greed person, let's say, I want, I want, I want, then on that wheel, when you come to something, and again, it's something that you want, your habit pattern, your karmic history is going to push you into wanting again. But practice allows us to see that karmic history. If we keep paying attention year after year, we begin to see the habits of our mind and how they push us forward into that next point on the wheel and how that karmic habit is going to continue our suffering. So I imagine the Buddha explaining all of this to his 5 friends. Because the understanding of our past action and our unknown future brings us very firmly into this present moment. What can we do right here and now? And it seems to me that this is one of the most valuable things that we do in this practice, is we keep coming here. What can I do here? I can't change the past, but I can certainly change this moment here. And I can't change the future because it hasn't happened yet. The world has a lot of troubles. And recently, someone that I haven't seen in a long time, but I've had a couple of emails with over the years, wrote and said, my husband and I are so confused about the situation in Syria. we have differing points of view, we worry about this versus that, human rights versus, you know, entering someone else's country. We would really appreciate your perspective. Oh my God. I'm looking at this thinking, I am so unqualified to answer this. And so I was very honest when I wrote back. I said, I really apologize because I don't have probably anything of significance to say to you on this particular subject. You're right, it's very complicated. And, you know, it's that weighing of in the balance of human rights versus sovereign rights. And, you know, we're holding up our American values when we don't even tend to uphold them in our own country. What does that mean? But what I came back to was exactly what I've been talking about today. The problem is not out there. The problem is always right here, in the hearts and minds of human beings. We can make a difference, but we often can't make the difference out there. I mean, I don't have a red phone to call the president and say, by the way, the Buddhist community thinks. So the only thing that I can do as a little person in this very big world is create peace and clarity here, right here, in this one. And I take it with me to school, and I take it with me to my meditation group, and I fail over and over again. But I think that that is what the Buddha was trying to share with his five friends, and what his legacy is to us. So I wish you all great peace and clarity. And I think that's the only thing we can actually do to and offer to the rest of the world.